five, six, seven, eight, nine, ten.
All right, we got ourselves an episode. Hello and welcome to A Century in Cinema. My name is Arthur, local filmmaker here in Utah, and the titular deer in Killing of a Sacred Deer.
And I'm Andrew, professional film historian, and we are entering our third and final winter of A Century in Cinema. I make so many jokes about Utah's fall only lasting 2 weeks, and I'm always saying it so flippantly that I forget every single time that is literally true. It's always 2 weeks of fall, and then boom, here we go.
Yep. It was 90 degrees 2 weeks ago, and now it's like 20 degrees. It's really cold. Okay, what is this? This is a podcast where we watch and discuss a classic film that I have not seen.
But I most likely have.
From every year. This week, we are in 2017. We're watching A Ghost Story, directed by David Lowery. And you had not seen this, Andrew.
I had not.
So that's always kind of fun. A fresh take from both of us.
This is the last film on the list that I have not seen before, so.
For any new listeners, you can find where our movies are streaming or available to rent online down in the link in our show notes. I rented this one on Amazon. I'm assuming you did the same.
I signed up for the free Showtime subscription.
Oh, nice.
And then immediately deleted my subscription, which is a fun way to do things.
I think I might have already taken advantage of that because I didn't see that option today. But listeners can still do that, probably.
Probably, maybe. You're going to have to go and find out.
We are nearing the end of our podcasting journey. If you have been with us for a while and have not taken the time to head on over to Apple Podcasts, give us a nice little 5-star rating and a few nice words in a review, you should take the time to do that now because we'd really, really appreciate it.
It'll be interesting to see what happens with this project in the future.
I hope a million people find it after we're done. And find joy and happiness.
And we're in our 80s.
Oh, that far off. Sure, why not? Why not?
It's a time capsule.
Should we talk about what's going on in 2017? Speaking of time capsules.
Yes, tell me everything you can about the year 2017 in modern history.
I mean, 2017 was like, what, a few years ago?
It was 5 years ago.
We are in the modern era, and I'm just going to miss a bunch of stuff that you're probably going to remember. I am just going off of Wikipedia here, the major events at the very top of the article, 2017. So here we go. Andrew, do you remember the total solar eclipse that moved across the United States? The Great American Eclipse?
I do. There was this really, really hot man named Aaron, who I still follow on Instagram, and he came to Chick-fil-A and brought me solar eclipse glasses.
So Andrew was able to watch the solar eclipse with his hot friend.
And I, you know what I did? I did the dummy thing. I was looking right up at you with the glasses and was just like casually like, whatever, and took them off while I was still looking up. And you're not supposed to do that. I wouldn't recommend it. You're not supposed to do that.
There's footage of Trump doing that. Yeah, don't do that.
Is there really?
Yeah. What else is going on in outer space? The Cassini spacecraft descends into Saturn's atmosphere at the end of its mission. It had been sending back beautiful pictures of Saturn. A lot of the famous pictures of Saturn came from the Cassini spacecraft, and this is the end of its mission. Back on Earth, North Korea tests a series of missiles. A lot of people around the world, most other nations, don't really like this. Crazy dictators throwing nuclear weapons everywhere. Yeah, not a great thing. Catalonia votes for independence from Spain, but I don't think the vote is recognized. It probably becomes a big deal. I don't know anything about this. I do know a few things about the 2017 Las Vegas shooting, which becomes the deadliest mass shooting in American history.
Oh, yeah. It was a concert?
Yeah, just someone up in a building spraying machine gun fire down on them. To this day, I am terrified of being in crowds. I don't trust the wackos out there in our great nation. anyone can just go get, you know, anything. The war against ISIS comes to a close this year in Iraq and Syria. I don't know much about this either. I'll admit it.
We don't really know too much about it in general, right?
I think we do. I think just we don't.
Oh, we're just dumb.
We're just dumb. And that's, you know, our own fault. I saw here a whole article, the Battle of Mosul. I had no idea that this whole military operation went down in Iraq. It was mainly conducted by the Iraqi government with help from allies. And it was the largest urban conflict since World War II, as the Iraqi government goes in and retakes this ISIS stronghold. You know, there's a whole article on it. Go read that.
Yeah.
We talk about movies. I remember in 2017, I was working on the set of Yellowstone, the first season of Yellowstone. It was in the art department. It was a lot of fun. That's actually where I saw the solar eclipse. We were working that day, and everyone took some time to go outside and get the eclipse glasses and go watch it. It was a really great time with all of my coworkers. I have fond memories of that because we were all very stressed. Also in 2017 on the set of Yellowstone, all of the Harvey Weinstein stuff went down. Harvey Weinstein was one of the main producers on the show.
It's the last show he produced. I mean, I think like that was a pretty huge moment in media.
Oh, for sure. I mean, it's the beginning of the Me Too movement. This is a huge deal. A lot of high-powered men who have been taking advantage of women and their status and their power in the industry and in Hollywood mainly just begin to fall. Not all of them. It's important. There are still a lot of predators out there.
Yes. It's a predatory environment, unfortunately.
For sure. This is also the year of the huge women's march in Washington, D.C., because Trump has just taken office. I don't know if Harvey Weinstein actually goes down if Trump's not in office, because this is like a retaliatory, I think this feels like a retaliatory moment against the
politics of the nation at large.
Yes, that's a good way to put it.
Because there was this very famous Trump audio clip of him describing a non-consensual sexual act on a woman that went everywhere and did nothing and nobody cared. And it was very distressing. And I mean, that is not the only thing about Trump that was distressing about that election, not by a long shot. But it was a huge thing of, isn't this enough to disqualify him? And it turns out it wasn't.
And it turns out that this kind of behavior is prevalent in our culture. And a lot of people said it shouldn't be. It should not be. And I think it's a great thing to see that there's a shift that happens in 2017. You know, I wish more would come of it, because it still feels like there's a lot of people who are evil out there and are predatory. But I don't know. This is still a good thing.
Yes. If only all of these people had seen Babyface in 1933.
That's the most noteworthy thing going on in the film industry that I remember in 2017. But Andrew, what else is going on?
Well, I mean, it was a pretty rough year at the domestic box office. There were so many like major flops this year. There was the Stephen King adaptation, The Dark Tower. There was Justice League. There was the Luc Besson sci-fi epic Valerian and the City of a Thousand Planets.
Oh, yeah.
And there was King Arthur. And then there was that infamous The Mummy reboot. But yeah, a lot of pretty big flops.
Including Blade Runner 2049. Big flop.
Big flop. But we don't talk about that one because that one's a good movie.
But we love that one, yeah.
Yeah. But then at the same time, you had these huge box office sensations of Despicable Me 3, Boss Baby, the Emoji Movie, these kids' movies that suddenly were just so huge. I mean, Wonder Woman was a pretty big success. What are our top 10? What are we looking at here at the box office?
Number one at the box office this year, it's got to be Star Wars Episode
8.
The Last Jedi. I don't know. Do you have strong opinions on this film?
I like it.
It's definitely the most interesting Star Wars film out there. I would concede to that.
I mean, it's dumb, but only from a narrative sense. I think the form of the film is actually quite lovely at times. I think it's pretty. Well, I think it's pretty. Because, like, I hated Wonder Woman. And, again, I don't care about the story, but visually, it was just a complete nothing. It just felt like there was no vision at all. I really disliked that.
Hmm.
I didn't see Justice League. Did you?
No, I still haven't. I'm not into superhero movies at this point in time, 2017. There was a brief moment in 2019 when I watched way too many of them. But Star Wars Episode 8 was the last film in the Star Wars saga that I was able to go see with other people, where we were all excited about it. And yeah, the mood in the theater was really, really strange. It was weird walking out because the entire audience, you could tell they weren't into it. And from here on out, I feel like Star Wars films have not done as well at the box office. Something about the franchise breaks. But still got a lot of loyal fans, a lot of people who will still go see anything that has the Star Wars label on it, especially if it's a TV show. Yeah, it's not going anywhere, but something shifts here. At number two at the worldwide box office, Beauty and the Beast, $1.2 billion. Now, I know you're a huge fan of the Disney live-action
adaptation. I said in a Patreon episode that this was my favorite one. And I stand by that. I think that it's a horrible, horrible movie. And a lot of it doesn't work. But there are a few songs that I like. And some of the visuals are nice. End of list. What's number three?
The Fate of the Furious. I have no idea which number this one is, but it is The Fate of the Furious.
Wait, what do you mean you don't know? It's right there in the title. It's the eighth one.
Oh, duh. It's duh, fate, duh, 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 duh. It is not spelled with the eight on Box Office Mojo.
They're cowards. I don't trust them. But that has also been like one of the underlying narratives of this podcast project is how unreliable and horrible Box Office Mojo is as a website.
Box Office Mojo, update your website. Come
yeah,
on.
Yeah, let's get that together.
Oh, Box Office Mojo by IMDb. That explains it. IMDb.
Dun, dun, dun.
But this is weird. According to Box Office Mojo, the foreign box office of The Fate of the Furious is higher than any other film on this list, even Star Wars, even Beauty and the Beast.
I believe that.
Fate of the Furious is putting asses in seats around the world. And then also in the top 10, you got Despicable Me 3, Jumanji, Spider-Man Homecoming. But you also have up there in the top 10, Wolf Warrior 2. Have you seen this film?
No.
Do you know what this film is?
Wolf Warrior 2? No.
It's a Chinese film. Right up there at number 7 at the worldwide box office. Hollywood has been depending on the Chinese market to prop up its huge blockbusters, and the Chinese film industry has taken notice in recent years, for sure. Yeah, a lot of giant Chinese blockbusters start creeping up onto the top box office lists. They don't really export them to us. We don't see them. They're for domestic audiences in China. We got to move on. What are your obscure recommendations for the year 2017?
I first want to recommend Ruben Östlund's The Square.
Yes.
Which is a hilarious, dark comedy about the... What am I trying to say? Yeah, the superficial nature of the art world, the art critic world, and the art collecting world. It is a send-up of museums and art curations, but is also a sly message about the prestigious film industry, and then won the Palme d'Or at Cannes, which is funny. It's very funny that that happened. And it's a very funny movie, great performances from Claes Bang and Elizabeth Moss, and a stunning sequence played by Terry Notary, where he is a performance artist playing an ape and causes chaos at a nice dinner. One of my favorite scenes I saw in a movie that year. And what's funny, I didn't know this until now, he played one of the motion capture apes in the Planet of the Apes movies, the new, more recent ones. So
oh,
that's
funny. That makes sense.
Next up, I want to recommend the film Loveless by Andrei Zvyagintsev. Yeah, see, I'm bad at this part. But this is a really fantastic movie. It's shot in a way that sort of makes you feel cold while you're watching it. It's about these two parents who they're fighting and their very young child just goes missing and they are searching and searching endlessly for him. And it's a very haunting film. It's very bleak, very sad, but beautiful to watch. And I think a really important film about the way we treat people, the way we look upon our loved ones, and the way we take things for granted. And then I'm also going to recommend the film Good Time by the Safdies.
Still got to watch this one.
A crazy movie about these two brothers who attempt a bank robbery, and it goes horribly wrong. The whole thing takes place over one night. Amazing performances from Robert Pattinson and Benny Safdie. Just a wild ride of a movie, and it really put the Safdies on the map, which I think is a net positive for the film industry. And I'm excited to see what they do next. Their next movie after this was Uncut Gems. But yes, I love Good Time. Very frenetic, very stressful, beautifully shot. Speaking of beautiful, frenetic, and painful to watch, I also loved Mother by Darren Aronofsky this year. Wonderful movie. But we kind of already talked about Darren Aronofsky at length, so I'm going to not go into that one too much.
Yeah, for more on Darren Aronofsky, definitely check out our Noah episode from 2014.
Two of my favorite things that came out this year, and that was first Reformed, directed by Paul Schrader, which is a remake of Ingmar Bergman's Winter's Light, almost a shot-by-shot remake for the first third, and then it turns the story on its head by bringing in modern America and the capitalism of the church in America. And the way this film handles the politics of American religion is something that you just don't see many movies approach, let alone as steadfast and persistent as this movie does. It's almost uncomfortable, but God, it's great. And Ethan Hawke gives the performance of a lifetime in the lead role. Highly recommended. And then my favorite, you know what? I'm going to call it a movie. My favorite movie of 2017 was David Lynch's Twin Peaks, The Return.
It's not a movie. It's a show. It's a TV show.
But it is. It is. It's meant to be watched show. In a very concentrated setting. You haven't even seen
it. That's a TV show. I'm going to cut this part.
No. No, it is. It really is. That was part of the genius of it, was that this season of television really did feel like a very long form film. The way it's edited and presented, it was released weekly on Showtime, and it was absolutely impossible to follow while it was coming out, because these plot points that were happening right next to each other, these moments that were happening immediately, were having to wait a week to be digested. The whole thing takes place over the course of about 5 days. And in the middle of our culture just deciding to bathe themselves daily in nostalgia and every single thing being this cash grab of attention of, oh, remember this thing? Oh, remember this thing? And all of these reboots and remakes, comes this incredible artistic statement from truly one of the masters of modern cinema in my eyes, David Lynch. And it's just a refutation of all of that. It is a Twin Peaks season that comes out 25 years later. But it does not, it's not made to satisfy Twin Peaks fans. It's made to be this incredible film. You could watch this completely separately from Twin Peaks, and there would be small moments you might not fully understand, but you could follow the story as a whole. And it's just a beautiful novelistic story that has multiple different angles and universes. And the way it tells this incredibly dense story is so entertaining and so well done. Kyle MacLachlan plays four different roles in this show, and every single one of them is just spot on. His villain is so terrifying to watch. You get really scared whenever he comes on screen, especially around halfway through the season. And he also plays this character named Dougie, who is just the most heartwarming, gentle character, and you're just rooting for him so hard. And he plays these characters so well, you forget that it's the same actor and just start following the characters. It's a wonderful performance. And this is just a wonderful, wonderful piece of media. I absolutely love Twin Peaks The Return. I think it's a masterpiece. And I am not afraid to call it my favorite movie of 2017.
TV's taken off. Cool.
Anyone who's watched it knows what I'm talking about. They know that it's a movie. It's a movie that was too long to be released in theaters.
Kind of like Stranger Things.
No, not at all like that.
A little bit like that. I haven't seen either of them, but I'm going to say it's like that.
He's trying to rile me up. Why do you think this is, audience? Do you like Call Me By Your Name? Do you like pedophiles? I'm just kidding.
it seemed like a good movie.
It was fine. Baby Driver was great. Lady Bird was great. Get Out was incredible. Yeah, a lot of great movies this year. And we already mentioned Blade Runner. And I don't want to talk about any of the Marvel movies from this year.
My favorite film from this year was The Florida Project. Did you like that one?
I love that movie. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. My obscure recommendation for the year is going to be The Breadwinner, though. An animated film from Nora Twomey. I think I'm pronouncing that correctly. But she was the director of The Secret of Kells. A few more people have seen that one. It's a little bit more charming, a little bit more childish. The Breadwinner is a story that takes place in Afghanistan. It follows a girl who pretends to be a boy in order to provide for her family under Taliban rule. I remember crying during this film. I loved this.
Yeah, I don't know why I haven't watched this yet. It's been on the watch list for so long, but I'm sure I will love it.
There's a lot to watch out there. But yeah, this one's definitely worth it. The Breadwinner. Great animated film.
See, I thought you were going to say your favorite movie was Shape of Water.
I mean, that's up there too, for sure.
Yeah.
Oh, The Death of Stalin comes out this year. You like that one?
I had that one up as a recommendation and cut it. I had that one and Phantom Thread up as other recommendations and cut them.
Well, we will briefly recommend them in passing here. Before we move on to our film of the week, our marquee topic, we're talking about A Ghost Story, a small little film from the A24 studio, directed by David Lowery. Andrew, you've got the plot.
So A Ghost Story tells a very simple tale about a man only ever acknowledged as C and his wife only ever acknowledged as M. We will most likely be referring to them as their actors' names, Casey Affleck and Rooney Mara, throughout this episode. And Casey Affleck doesn't want to leave the home that him and his wife are living in. Rooney Mara does. Casey Affleck agrees to move out and the next day dies in a car crash. And we follow his ghost, which is presented as him under an almost comical bed sheet with little holes poked out. And he becomes sort of trapped in this house that he didn't want to leave and watches time pass at first very slowly and then suddenly quite rapidly. And we see his ghost go through different phases of people's lives, of the world at large. And then the movie sort of takes a very strange turn where he seems to be in the far future and does not wish to exist anymore and attempts to sort of kill himself as a ghost and then goes all the way back in time to before the house was even built and comes back to the moment when his wife leaves again, and this time he can see his own ghost already in the house. Throughout this strange turn of events, this poetic story, if you will, he is aware that his wife has hidden a letter inside of the wall of the house, but has been unable to reach it. And now that he has the second chance inside the house, he is able to grab the note. He opens it, a door opens, and suddenly he disappears.
Spoiler alert for A Ghost Story. Yeah.
What's funny is it really is too late, but strangely enough, I do think this kind of is a movie that could be spoiled, but I stand by how I feel about spoilers in that I can tell you all of that, but the experience of watching this film is something that really can't be spoiled. This movie, you have to experience it to even understand. If I was to write out the plot itself, it would, you know, just be like a few points.
So how would you kind of describe the tone and the feeling of this film?
It's a mood piece.
Okay.
That is trying to get across the feelings of isolation and loneliness, and it is the realization of hope that only comes after death in a nihilistic world.
Yeah, it's haunting.
What did you think of this movie?
I loved this film.
Me too.
I really, really liked it, yeah. I have only revisited a handful of films on our list. I've only watched a few of them a second time, and this was one of those films where as soon as I was finished with it, I said to myself, I want to watch that again. I have to experience it another time. And I did the exact same day. I really liked a ghost story.
Oh, you watched it again the same day?
Yeah.
That's a high compliment, in my opinion, I think.
I mean, it's very short. It's about 90 minutes. So you watch it twice, and that's about the length of a typical Marvel film. But it's about 10 times as rewarding.
Yeah.
Yeah, I thought this film was extraordinary. I've been reading the Grimm fairy tales. It's kind of Halloween time right now, and I've been in a mood to take in haunting little stories like this one. And this kind of just fit right in with the fairy tales that I've been reading about. In fact, David Lowry's other film that recently came out, The Green Knight, is an Arthurian legend, an adaptation of an old sort of fairy tale. And this feels like it fits into the same tone as something like that. It's very simple, but the themes that it's exploring feel very universal and applicable.
Now, I want some credit here because I can't remember what was originally in 2017, but we agreed we wanted to change it. And I recommended this movie, even though I hadn't seen it, because I've been wanting to watch it for so long. And I thought, I want to get one I want to watch on here. I don't know if you remember this, but you were very hesitant. You're like, is that even supposed to be good? And I said, I think people love that movie. Yeah, I don't know. Something has always drawn me to this movie. I wanted to see it while it was in theaters, and I missed it. And that made me very sad. And I had never gotten around to watching it on TV. Yeah, it was kind of my opportunity to say, this is a movie I really want to watch. And so it's on the list kind of for me. But yeah, I'm really happy you loved it too, because I just knew I was going to like this. I knew as soon as I saw the first trailer for it that this was going to be sort of my vibe. I mean, you know me and my aesthetics. I mean, God, I couldn't ask for a more beautiful aesthetic. I mean, it's just so well thought out and so well presented, but mm-hmm. also so simple. You know, I mean, you have to have a professional DP, surely, to get this kind of lighting and make it look like this. But the lighting setups themselves and the way the movie is presented, I mean, it's all very simple.
Very simple. Very, very simple.
But it just tells such a beautiful, meaningful story. And yes, it feels like a poem. I actually did watch this again as well. I just watched it a second time earlier today while I was putting together notes for the show and making my dinner. So I wasn't really getting my 100% full attention, but I know I'll be revisiting this multiple times. Yeah, it really captured my imagination, and it really spoke to something that I'm very passionate about talking about, which is the loneliness of our modern world. I having experienced quite a bit of that loneliness myself, I try to reach out to people and, you know, sort of as a way of making people feel less lonely, let them know, hey, I feel that way too. And I feel like that's what this movie's at its core trying to do, is sort of be like, hey, you're not the only person feeling this way. This is sort of the way of the world in general. And it kind of has been like this for a while. But there is, you know, meaning behind things. I made it was sort of like a flippant comment about a nihilistic world earlier. I do think this movie is, I do think it's very anti-nihilism. Like,
It is.
It's showing this sort of meaningful transference of information, memory, and emotion that goes beyond our lives, which is, you know, an insane theme, an insane concept to base your 90-minute independent film around. But I have nothing but respect for it, and I think it's done. I really would say I think it's done perfectly. I wouldn't change anything about this movie.
Yeah, me neither.
I would make the pie-eating scene 10 minutes longer.
Yeah, Rooney Mara, take your time. Yeah, but it's a modern fairy tale. Like you said, it is speaking towards something that I think a lot of us experience in today's world, and that is loneliness. And it is a plea for us to connect to one another and to, like you said, reach out and really value the relationships we have while we're alive.
Yeah, really good movie.
For the record, 2017 was originally going to be The Greatest Showman.
Oh, that's right. I'm so happy we didn't do that. You got your Bone Tomahawk episode. You got your episode of me just angrily ranting. Yeah, I would not have enjoyed that as much.
I still have not seen The Greatest Showman, but I do want to say, Andrew, yes, thank you. Thank you. I do owe you for changing our 2017 film to a ghost story. This one was spectacular.
I didn't know going in. I just, you know, really wanted to watch it. So
I have heard from people that they're bored by it. I've heard from people who don't love it. It's not their cup of tea. But yeah, this was definitely my cup of tea.
Yeah, I mean, okay. Like, I get it, but also, you know, I actually don't. I want to say I get it because I want to empathize, but I agree there are moments that are very slow in the film, but they feel so deliberate. Every single slow moment in the movie is followed up pretty quickly by a much more tense, almost horrific moment. The music really paces it out well. I don't know. I don't know. I don't understand it because I feel like the movie is so well paced. I don't get it.
It is well paced.
I wouldn't call this boring. I would call it slow and deliberate. I would not call it boring. And I don't even know if it's slow in the final third.
No, it's very, very fast. It is worth noting, this is not a horror film. It's a haunting film. It will stick with you, but it's not a horror film. It's not going to make you scared. It's not trying to make you scared.
Yeah, it's a haunting drama with the title A Ghost Story that has jump scares. But I would agree, absolutely, it is not a horror film.
I do love this depiction of ghosts and hauntings, though, seeing this situation from the ghost perspective, because this is how our society sees ghosts, right? They are people who have passed away who cannot move on. Casey Affleck, when he's a ghost for the first time in the hospital, he's presented with this doorway where he can move on to whatever else is next, but he chooses to turn away from that door and return to the home and just sticks around there. And he's trying to figure out, okay, now what? What am I going to do? And yeah, he becomes angry at times. And that's when things start to become the traditional sort of like ghost haunting a space. So yeah, this is a very familiar story that we are aware of in our culture. This is what ghosts are supposed to do, but this film takes it to the next level and says, okay, what happens when that house is torn down? What happens when decades have passed on and the ghost is still just wandering around this space? What do they do now? What's going on there? Yeah, it was really melancholy, really sad. The other ghost in the other house that he can see, and they're talking to each other through subtitles, because it's kind of like a silent film at times. They're talking
like
to each
other.
An hour
of the movie with no talking in it, I think.
Yeah. But this other ghost in this other house that he can see tells him that they're still waiting for someone to return, but they don't even remember who they're waiting for. They're just waiting.
That really broke my heart, actually. That made me so emotional.
Man. Yeah.
There's this very infamous scene where Rooney Mara is just eating a pie for, I believe, 6 minutes straight.
Which is a big chunk of the film. It's only 90 minutes.
Right. And that's kind of the go-to when people say the movie is boring or slow. But again, you know, you sit there for 5 minutes and watch that. And then immediately it's that scene with him seeing the other ghost and the music gets all tense and the conversation is so sort of scary and spectral and sad and the situation just becomes so much more mysterious and there's so much intrigue. It's like, okay, yeah, I didn't mind sitting through that pie eating scene because it got me to a really incredible moment. And I mean, honestly, the pie eating scene was a really incredible moment too.
It's a good scene.
Yeah.
It's a good scene. I love it because she's heartbroken. She's in mourning. And yeah, she's just devouring this pie.
I have, Arthur, I've literally done that.
Yeah.
Not the whole pie, but I have baked a pie, realized there was no one else to eat it, and I have sat down on the living room floor with the TV going and just gone at it with a fork. I don't eat it like that. I don't go that fast. I eat it slowly throughout the night.
Well,
I was like, oh, wow, this is a very good depiction of depression because my depression has absolutely manifested in this exact way before.
We've been there, Rooney. We've been there. And the people who are angry, they just don't want to admit it.
Right.
Let's talk about the general reaction from film critics and audiences back in 2017. We're already kind of mentioning that audience members were divided.
I will say you've mentioned people in your circles have had critiques. In my circles, this was a beloved movie. And at this point, you know, I mean, I was very much in the art house film crowd, and most of my friends were more into independent and artistic cinema, so it sort of makes sense that they would all love this so much. But yes, this was a highly recommended movie that I really wanted to see, and because of time and everything, and isn't that what the whole movie's about? But because of time, I was unable to see it in theaters. The critical reaction was pretty positive across the board.
Overwhelmingly positive, according to the critics on Rotten Tomatoes. But then you look over at IMDb, and the ratings are a little bit lower, 6.8, not the best of all time.
It's funny you should bring that up, because our review for today is from Red Letter Media, who we'll talk about in a moment. But they mention at the end the Redbox reviews. Were you even aware of that? Were you even aware of that as a concept in the world?
No, but that was one of the reasons I chose this review. I loved those Redbox reviews, man. Because they recite them, spelling errors and all.
It has a 2 out of 5 stars on Redbox. It is a very low-rated movie. And that makes complete sense to me. Because Redbox, the whole point of it is it's something you pick up quickly with your family while you're at the grocery store. It's just supposed to be a movie. Like, I don't think there's anything wrong with that, truly. I think, like, if movies help you relax at the end of the day and you want one that will help you relax and you're at the grocery store and pick up one from Redbox, I see nothing wrong with that conceptually. But I do see how it would be completely unkind to a movie like A Ghost Story, which demands your full attention and is trying to do something bigger than your average movie. And because of that, it's like, I'm literally cooking a frozen pizza in my oven and have to feed a family of 6 tonight. So I really don't have time for this, Rooney. Like, I can totally understand it. But that doesn't stop the reviews from being absolutely hilarious.
One of my favorite reviews that they're mentioning, someone's like, I thought I paused the film, but it was still going.
Just very slowly. That was great. Great stuff.
I had heard from people that A Ghost Story is iffy. Maybe I'm just more out of touch with the art house world. Maybe I'm more in touch with the common folk, Andrew. You know.
You just called them that. You're not going to be in touch with them for much longer after those sorts of shenanigans.
Anyways, should we talk about Red Letter Media? We did mention Red Letter Media in our
Dance of Reality episode.
Because I feel like when it comes to internet film criticism, they're one of the biggest names out there.
I would agree.
I know them as Mike and Jay, according to Wikipedia here. Mike Stoklasa and Jay Bauman. Sorry about the pronunciation there. But Mike and Jay. We know him as Mike and Jay.
Yes. Also, I'm just going to say it. I've always thought it. Jay Bauman's hot. He's so hot.
Jay, if you're listening. Mike, step up your game, I guess. I don't know. They're hilarious.
Yes. I love their discussions.
Always really articulate, and I think they have pretty good opinions. For the most part, I agree with them. And yeah, they're just really hilarious. That's what you need to be a modern film critic. You need to be funny. Are we funny? Do people think we're funny?
I think so.
We think we're funny. We laugh a lot during
this. I think we're funny. I laugh when I listen. Yeah, I think we're funny.
I feel like this is a popular internet content genre. Two dudes talking. Andrew, does that sound familiar?
A little bit. Sounds like something we could do. You know what I mean?
We could make a podcast.
I was watching Half in the Bag and I was like, we could do that. Let's do that.
And every other pair of white dudes out in America thought the same thing. Yeah, this is like the go-to format for a lot of podcasts out there is just two guys talking about whatever the hell they want to talk about. And, you know, Red Letter Media does it really well. I hope we do it really well, too, but we're definitely part of this trend. Anyways, they love this movie. They articulate why they love this movie really well. I would recommend people listen to them after they're done listening to us. Why not? Was there anything else that jumped out to you about this? Because I definitely wanted to talk about the Redbox reviews. Those were funny.
Yeah, that was the highlight for me personally. It was wonderful getting to see them unabashedly love a movie. For both of them, they said it was their favorite movie of the year. They both felt like they came away from the movie and had more to think about. One of the points Mike brought up, which is funny to me because honestly, this doesn't even cross my mind. I'm almost too open and forgiving with movies sometimes, and I know that about myself. But they both say that they went into it expecting hipster art house bullshit. And for the first 10 minutes, they were really terrified that that's exactly what it was. But once it sort of became itself and started telling the actual tale, they were both really enamored with it and thought it was wonderful. Which is funny to me because there is, you know, a hipster bullshit character in this movie. And it's like the closest thing we have to a villain in the plot.
Are you talking about our hipster trash at the party?
Yes.
I saw a lot of comments online, people saying they hated that scene. Their least favorite part of the film, or that it totally derailed the film. And why would the filmmakers just state the theme of the film like this when everything else was so slow and subtle and deliberate, and then just have a character monologue about what the film was trying to express? Do you have any opinions about that scene, Andrew?
Well, I do not think he is expressing what the film is trying to express.
Well, what does he say?
Well, he's pretty much saying that just life is meaningless and that society will inevitably end. And it could potentially come back with hope, but even hope itself is sort of a horrible thing for humanity at large because we need to end. And he's just talking about how life is nothing but just particles smashing against each other and nothing means anything and there's no point to anything.
And eventually, none of this matters because the sun is going to engulf the earth anyways and the universe will collapse in the end. So. Nothing matters. Nothing matters.
But, you know, I think that he is supposed to represent the, you know, the anxiety, the voice inside of our heads. I don't see him as an actual character. I see him as this. I know I have these thoughts in my head all the time. I really do. Of just what is the purpose of anything? What is the point? And I've definitely gone so far as to think the whole world's just going to end someday anyways. And the way I bring myself out of it, like the way I think out of it is, you know, I remember the impact I've had on people around me and how I could hope to impact other people. And, you know, if we are going to be stuck on this rock that is hurtling through space, then why not make the best of it? I mean, we are here, you know, why does there need to be a point? And I think that that in itself is kind of the point, is like, enjoy your time, try and, you know, be a benefit for those around you and appreciate and have gratitude for the life that you're experiencing because you're getting to experience it.
Yeah. Yeah. And to have a happy ending at the end of the day or the end of humanity or the end of the universe is not the point. I think the fact that this film jumps back in time and becomes like this cyclical structure at I think that's important because we could follow the ghost to the end of the universe, but we follow him back in time and he sees the world from a different perspective. And then he sees his relationship from a different perspective. And then he rethinks his role in that relationship and what the importance was there. I think the fact that this hipster guy at the party is so despicable, the fact that audiences hate him so much, I mean, that's clearly deliberate on the filmmaker's part. We are not supposed to buy into what he's saying, even though it makes sense, even though it is almost like what you feel like the film is talking about, the nihilism of the world and human experience in the universe. It feels like that's the trajectory of the film at that point. So you think the film is just telling you exactly what it is, what its takeaway is. But no, the takeaway is like the exact opposite of what that guy is saying. Anyways, a lot of people clearly missed the point of that scene. And I also saw some people who really love that scene who think that's what the point of the film is. And,
oh, no.
You know, these are people who are clearly just buying into the nihilism of our age. No.
Art is dangerous.
No. No, that is not what this film is about. But I don't know, if you turn it off at that point in time, maybe that is the big takeaway. It is for some people.
Yeah, I don't really understand how you could make it all the way to the end of the film and think that was the point it was trying to make. But, you know, that's their interpretation. And I'm going to say it, there's some validity to it if that's what you interpret. If people are walking away from this film with a more nihilistic viewpoint, then that is clearly something the film is capable of achieving. You know what I mean?
Yeah. And since it is like a silent film at some points, I mean, it's not exactly telling you what the big takeaway is. Yeah, it's open to some interpretation for sure.
It's so weird. No expression is done. There's not even really movement, but you can tell the ghost is not into it. Like, you can tell he's angry, and seeing him be upset by it, and then, of course, causing the light to flicker and its implied explode, was a visual cue to me that this is infuriating to the ghost. And the ghost, I do think, is supposed to represent the audience. I mean, visually, there are these moments where it feels like we are the ghost watching the ghost, and then we're the ghost watching the ghost watching the ghost, which is impressive, I think, to pull off. But the way this film is presented visually, it's very voyeuristic. It does make you feel like you are also a member of this group that just can't quite escape or move, and you're not even sure why you're watching certain moments, and you're not sure why you're stuck here. So the ghost is clearly supposed to represent us. Is that fair? Do you feel like that's the thing?
I definitely think that's a thing. The characters are so empty, flat. They're just archetypes. It's the guy and the girl.
They didn't even get names.
We fill them up with our own experiences, yeah?
Right. And the ghost is presented as a person under a sheet. There's no indication of what the person looks like.
Yeah, yeah. When we see Casey Affleck, I am reminded, oh, it's Casey Affleck.
Right.
I don't know how you feel about Casey Affleck.
He's given a lot of great performances and a lot of great movies.
But he kind of seems like a person I'd like to not be around.
Yeah.
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 Was this before, after, during his whole, the sexual abuse allegations, since we brought up Harvey Weinstein earlier?
You know, I think that Casey Affleck had been sued and was taken to court and settled outside of court before the Me Too movement. And then after the Me Too movement, I mean, he was definitely pulled back in and, you know, used as an example of, see, I mean, this is the kind of bullshit that men are pulling when they're in positions of power. And he admitted to bad behavior, said he wished he hadn't done said bad behavior. But yeah, he was using his status to try to coerce women in his crews to do things they didn't want to do. I don't know much else, though. Plus, he just looks kind of gross. I'm sorry.
I don't think he's hot. I don't think I've ever actually said that on this podcast. I don't think Casey Affleck is hot.
But Rooney Mara, elegance incarnate. Unbelievably attractive. Yes. Yes.
I've sought out so many movies with her in them, and I do think it's because she's a great actor, but she's also beautiful to look at on the screen. What's funny is that while she was downing the pie, all I could think was, Rooney Mara can't keep down a pie. That was literally all I could think was, like, sorry, you don't get that skinny by digesting pie. And then she went and threw it up in the scene itself. And I was like, oh, okay, well, I'm happy they kept that in, because I was in complete denial of this moment until that. Noah texted me. Noah loves this movie. And he let me know that Rooney Mara said in press around the release of the film that she had never eaten pie before.
Yeah, she doesn't look like she knows how to eat it.
Yeah.
She's like stabbing at it in a way that you're like, nah, she's never eaten a pie before.
Yeah, there is Hollywood skinny, and then there's Rooney Mara skinny. And there's nothing wrong with that. There's no shame to that at all, unless she is, like, you know, not eating, which is not good. But I'm not saying she isn't. I'm just saying,
if she's not.
Yeah, as long as she's healthy, then I'm happy.
David Lowery. David Lowery.
third rail. But David Lowery,
the director of this film.
You know, I met David Lowery and Rooney Mara the same day. I went and saw a screening of Ain't Them Body Saints when it premiered at the Rose Wagner Center during Sundance. And while it was just a Badlands remake, I thought it was a really good Badlands remake. I truly did.
And that also stars Casey Affleck.
Yes, Casey Affleck and Rooney Mara. But Casey was not at the screening.
And this was before A Ghost Story.
Yes, this was 2013. This was my second time ever going to Sundance.
Okay.
He was very pleasant. I was a little starstruck by Rooney. I mean, it was just like, you know, you just went up and got to see people and stuff. They were just at the edge of a stage. It wasn't like I had an intimate conversation with them.
Sure.
But it was still a really cool moment. And I really loved that movie and couldn't wait to see what he did next. And then what he did next was a Disney live action remake. Now, before we get into it, have you seen Peace Dragon?
Nope.
Okay, well, then I feel a little bit more free to say this. Like, I was never going to watch that movie. And I was really annoyed that I was even getting a remake. And I was so sad that yet another indie darling director got scooped up by the big Disney machine and made this live action remake.
I say let them make their money, but go ahead.
But I guess people say this is a very, very good movie. People love it.
Oh, okay.
And I'm interested in watching. I'm way more interested now because I thought A Ghost Story was just so fantastic. I was not as in love with The Green Knight as you were.
Okay.
There were moments in The Green Knight that I thought were very beautiful, and I thought the ending was really great. Again, that movie
really
also
great.
Yeah, I think that movie also has this sort of anti-nihilism thing going on. I mean, he's literally on a suicide mission throughout the whole movie. And at the end, it's sort of like, what was the purpose for all of this suffering? And it's sort of like that's just what was important to him. I think that The Green Knight is even more obtuse thematically than A Ghost Story is.
You can take from it what you want. And I definitely took something else from The Green Knight.
What did you take from The Green Knight?
I thought it was about environmentalism, for sure.
Yeah, I can see that.
Yeah, if there was any sort of commentary on nihilism in The Green Knight, that was second, third, maybe fourth to other stuff going on. But yeah, but I can see the parallels with style and storytelling beats. That being said, David Lowery definitely, as a director, definitely fits under the umbrella of the A24 brand. You know what I'm talking about.
I do.
And we love it. We love it. We're there for it. We love A24.
I will agree. I like A24 for their actual films. I legitimately think that they are a very good production studio that has put a lot of great voices at the forefront, has given funding to some really great movies. I don't much care for what A24 has done for film discussion and film production on a local and smaller scale, because now everybody's like, it has to be like an A24 movie, and nobody even knows what that means. If you say it's an A24 movie, that can mean A Ghost Story or it could mean Hereditary. And I'm sorry, but those are two completely different movies with different, goals and ambitions made by different artistic directors.
But that is different from like a Netflix horror movie or a Blumhouse horror movie.
Right.
There is a feeling to the A24 brand that actually, I would say, A Ghost Story and Hereditary do feel a little bit more alike than other stuff out there.
I guess. So you're just mainly talking aesthetics?
No, I'm talking a general tone and feeling. And aesthetics play into that for sure. When I do think of A24 films, I think of a lot of slower films. Cameras moving slower.
I just immediately think of Spring Breakers. And Bodies, Bodies, Bodies this year? Like, I don't know.
I haven't seen it yet.
Just because you're not going out and seeing the faster paced, like, bigger budget A24 movies doesn't mean they don't exist.
I don't know. It's the same way that people will describe the feeling of a director's work. And there are different kinds of director's films out there. I mean, a Steven Spielberg film still feels like a Steven Spielberg film, even if it's slow or fast. I mean, there's just elements that you can consistently find there. And you can talk about an A24 film. Any studio has certain things that trickle into the films.
But I think that's where I do completely disagree, because a Steven Spielberg film feeling like another Steven Spielberg film, that's because he's a well-established director who understands how to use his voice to propel the cinematic language that he's choosing to propel and to tell the story that he's wishing to tell. Whereas this is a production studio giving money to different creative heads and different directors who are then putting their own, like, I would compare David Lowery's films to each other. I wouldn't compare the works of David Lowery to the works of Robert Eggers simply because they came from the same production studio. I don't know. I would. This is something that has been driving me crazy recently in film discourse, is this idea that A24 is in any way sort of like responsible for any of the artistic decisions, because they've been able to fund a bunch of directors who would rather use physical film and would rather tell more intimate stories. I don't think that that means that I don't see A24 as having like input of, oh, everybody needs to be doing this on like 16 millimeter now. You know, like I don't see that. I see that as still a creative decision that needs to be made by the team who's responsible for the film. I don't know. That's where I'll put my foot in the ground. I do like A24 as a production company because of the movie that they have produced and because of the artists that they have elevated. I don't see them as like a creative part of the movie. I don't watch an A24. I don't watch a movie from A24 and be like, yeah, it was like every other A24 movie. Like I would watch a David Lowery movie and say it was a lot like his other work.
Yeah, I mean, you can definitely make comparisons with other directors. I don't know. You had described in our Bone Tomahawk episode how there's a Netflix look. And I understood what you meant by that. And I still think that there is an A24 look out there. And I'm not articulate enough to describe it at the moment, but I think it's out there. And maybe it's almost by coincidence that they're choosing directors and people who have this similar style, this similar vibe. But I do think it's out there.
Yeah, like, when I say the Netflix look, that's because Netflix has these studio mandates of them using these specific lots. And they really do have a lot of input on what cameras you can use, because it has to be done digitally. And you have to use their visual effects houses and stuff. Like, there's a lot that Netflix actually is in charge of. They are responsible for. And you're sort of limited with the resources. I mean, you get the occasional film like Roma, where the director did get to do everything he wanted to do just using Netflix money. But for the most part, if it's a Netflix show or if it's a film funded by Netflix, it's going to be made by Netflix's rules. And and that's every production studio. So, of course, that does apply to A24 as well. But it feels like A24 is giving directors a lot of freedom with how they want to express their vision and how they wish to make their films. So I think sort of homogenizing the films under their production company cheapens them in a way that I wouldn't want to. And again, like I think there's a lot of people out there who just want to make movies about depression. A24 is just the production company giving them money.
From what I understand, this film was produced independently of A24. A24 came in and distributed it.
Well, see, that very much proves my point.
I don't think it does. No, I don't think it does, because I think they're coming in as a distribution system, but they're choosing a film that they know is going to make them money. That's going to hit a certain audience that has reliably come back to A24-like films, and they are saying, oh, Ghost Story, this fits into our canon almost. This is what is proven to be a success for our brand. And that makes sense to me. So I don't think that I am cheapening it. I think that I am just trying to be realistic about what kind of films A24 produces or distributes, and saying that there is a vibe or a tone that works for them. And therefore, when I say there's a A24 type film, I think a lot of people know what I'm talking about out there. There's obviously exceptions like Spring Breakers, but I don't know. There's a vibe to them.
Okay.
And it doesn't, and it's not a vibe that is there in Blumhouse horror films. It's not a vibe there in, I don't know, Amazon Prime television. It's a style. I think it's there.
But I can concede to that. And I truly did not mean to at any point turn this on to this is what Arthur does. I was talking about, I mean, you have been at a film production meeting where someone suddenly says, oh, yeah, like A24 does or something. And it feels like they're saying absolutely nothing.
I think it's trendy to say it. And sometimes they don't know if that's actually what's useful or helpful for the film. Yeah. Yeah.
That's more what I hate.
Yeah.
That's more what I hate. As far as them picking the films to distribute and saying this fits our vibe and our audience that we've established, I would agree with that. I mean, obviously, and it's working for them. But I don't know. Like, The Lighthouse and a Ghost Story have such different vibes to me, even though they are both 4x3 movies that are dark and mildly confusing.
And you know, they are different, but that's something I'd expect from an A24 film, and not something I'd expect from an HBO film. Now, that's a great transition, which we have got to grab onto because we have got to move on. The aspect ratio of this film, I loved it.
I thought it was great. Yeah, I thought it did a great job of portraying this, like we are stuck in this room with the ghost.
Yeah, the boxy feeling of the almost like Polaroid square, which, you know, makes me think of memories captured in the distant past. Aspect ratio should always be a creative choice by the filmmakers. And yeah, this worked for the themes in the film.
Yeah, in general, there's a really deliberate and beautiful visual presentation in this film that leans into the poetry of its simple story and its characters. My favorite shots in the movie were when the house started turning into the huge skyscraper, and you see him in this big ghost costume walking through these huge rooms and in this huge concrete room. I loved all of that so much.
That whole montage was really chilling. And culminating with the moment where he goes onto the roof and looks over this almost futuristic skyline.
Blade Runner, full Blade Runner moment. I didn't see that one coming.
Not overly sci-fi, but definitely just enough to tell you that our ghost is not home anymore. He's not at home anymore. Anyways, that helps the film achieve a great sense of isolation and loneliness.
Ding! So that is 3 talking points down out of 10. No,
we did Rooney Mara in the pie.
Oh, I do want to talk about this ghost costume. I really went into this movie. I thought that it was going to be sort of a wink, wink. It's a ghost, but it's just a guy in a sheet. Like, I thought there was going to be some humor to it, and there really isn't, which I thought was wonderful. Once I understood what the movie was going for and the tone of the film, suddenly I realized, oh, this is going to be very serious. But even outside of that, presenting him as this huge figure under the sheet, I mean, there's this real weight and presence to him. It feels like something that would be impossible to ignore, and yet nobody can see him or touch him or interact with him. There was just something really profound about that bedsheet to me. I was very shocked at how effective that was in making it like legitimized the joke idea of a ghost costume, right? Because that ghost costume of just a sheet pulled over your head is supposed to be sort of this funny, I couldn't think of anything for Halloween, so I just put this on my head.
It's very childish.
Yes. And this makes it feel like, oh, if you were a ghost and you had this huge, weighty sheet on you that was just dragging everywhere you walked, and you were unable to effectively interact with so many things, and the people you wanted to see were still unable to notice you, there would just be a real sadness involved in it. It just really worked. I was so impressed by the effect of that costume.
Again, it's harkening back to that idea of your own past. You know, this is something you would have done as a kid, but yeah, taking it very seriously as an adult. I think it worked incredibly well. And as simple as the idea is, it was funny reading about how hard it was to pull off on set. Right. And once you actually start to think about it, you're like, oh, actually, this is really hard, because there is no sheet out there big enough to actually cover and drag behind a person like is needed in the film. And then, of course, the eye holes.
They couldn't get it to stay in place for the eye holes.
Even watching the film, I was like, oh, OK, so you've got to wear like a black mask under the sheet in order for these eye holes to have this really like dark abyss. We can't just look at Casey Affleck's eyes. I mean, no one wants that. And of course, as soon as you think about it, you're like, of course it would slip and it would not stay exactly where it needs to stay. And yeah, apparently they had to rig up some puppeteering effects to actually make the eye holes stay where they need to stay. And didn't you also feel like the eye holes were like showcasing expression at some points in the film? Like they looked shocked or they looked scared and they looked sad at certain points? Or was I just reading into that?
No, I already said something like that earlier, where I felt like the ghost was displaying anger at the hipster man. I feel like there's a lot of emotion portrayed with this simple costume and these eye holes. I hate saying the word eye holes, though. I don't like that.
Props to the art and costume department on this film. That looked hard.
I really liked the flower sheet ghost, because I don't know what that's supposed to imply to me visually, like what sort of story it's supposed to tell me. It obviously differentiated them, but also it's like, wait, is there like a reason that he's in a white bed sheet and she's in a flowered one? But I liked that. I don't know why I keep referring to that ghost as a she. I don't, there's nothing.
It's a flowery bed sheet.
Yeah, and I think that's probably something I need to break in my brain, truly.
It's 2017, Andrew. Get with the times.
Yeah, MTV's doing gender neutral awards. I need to get it together.
Andrew, why is Kesha in this film?
Did you see her and say, is that Kesha? Or did you just not even recognize her at all?
I don't know who Kesha is.
You know Kesha, the song TikTok.
Well, I know. But I've never actually seen her.
Okay.
Yeah, I've only heard her sing. She has a cameo in the hipster party.
And it makes no sense, and there's no reason for it to be there, and I don't mind it in any way. Seriously, I wouldn't have even brought it up. Part of what makes it so funny to me is that it's one of the most searched things about this movie. And even in the Wikipedia article, in the very beginning, in the very brief overview before the article proper, it's like, this is a supernatural drama film directed by David Lowery, starring Casey Affleck and Rooney Mara. Kesha appears briefly and has a few lines during a party scene, like she's mentioned in that opening bit. I don't know. It's so funny to me. Like, it's even anything, because in the movie itself, it isn't anything. And I think if this movie stands the test of time and is watched, you know, years and years from now, I think it will absolutely hit an audience eventually of people who just don't even understand that there's a Kesha cameo and don't care, and because her character is so not involved in the movie in any way.
But why is she here?
I don't know. I have no idea. Do you know? Do you know?
No, I have no idea. Is she? No one knows.
No, no one seems
to
know.
The most searched thing about this film. Well, when you type in why is Kesha in Ghost Story in Google, the first hit is did Kesha really sleep with a ghost from E! Online, which is not what I was asking.
She said that on, I think, Jay Leno.
This is recent. This is like 2022 news.
But the interview was from a long time ago.
Oh, I don't know anything.
Gosh, this is tough to read. She had such a tough year in 2017. Oh, David Lowery is a Kesha super fan. I mean, yeah, hello. I love her music. I really do. He hoped to use a Kesha song in a party sequence, but wound up getting her to not only appear in the movie, but also co-write a tune that plays in the background. The cameo was a crazy coincidence, Lowry says. A friend was at a party that Kesha just happened to be at and was like, hey, I've got some friends in Texas and they want you to be in their movie. 2 days later, she flew to Texas and did it. It was so last minute and spontaneous that I was really worried that she'd get there and be disappointed and realize that she had very little to actually do in that scene. But we wanted her to be there. Thankfully, she did it and she had a blast.
Wow. You know what? Good for him. I'm a Rooney Mara super fan if she wants to be in any of my films.
Let me call her. Hey, I've got some friends in Utah and you loved her in Pan. That's what I'm going to tell her. I'll be like, he thinks you were the best Princess Tiger Lily.
Do you believe that the budget of this film, A Ghost Story, is $100,000?
Is that what they're claiming?
I don't believe it.
That doesn't seem right.
Doesn't compute. There's micro budget and there's like money on the side of the road.
Yeah, clearly they're not accounting for the A24 marketing budget, which is fine. A lot of movies don't do that. But the marketing alone puts this in the millions. And did Rooney Mara and Casey Affleck just not get paid? I guess since they did Ain't Them Body Saints, I know that really was a very micro-budget movie, and they were both a little fresher at that point. So, like, maybe this was a favor? I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, $100,000 for a film that looks like this, even though this is really simple, like, that's the budget of just some people, like, making a movie in their backyard. That's some friends in Hollywood getting together and just throwing together a little film. And maybe, I don't know, maybe that's what this is.
No, Weta worked on this. Weta worked on this. Weta wouldn't be able, you wouldn't be able to get visual effects from them for like less than $1 million, surely.
The CGI to produce the sci-fi cityscape alone would eat up that budget. And then, of course, the pioneers and the costumes and the wagon and the
no,
art
I don't believe
this
it.
This is not $100,000.
I don't believe it.
Wikipedia.
I need to see the actual like breakdown if they are claiming
line that. Item receipts. The receipts. Everyone. David.
Let me look at this full cast and crew, because I mean, there's even like, and all these extras.
It's $100 per extra.
And there's like 1,000 extras. No.
Let us know in the Patreon comments if you enjoy listening to us do the math on the budget for A Ghost Story.
Looking at the visual effects and the camera department alone, I'm like, wait, no, there's no way all these people got paid. So who, I guess if you're claiming $100,000, who didn't get paid? Because you've got like 40 people in the music department alone.
Well, weird.
We don't have to believe everything we read, and we're not going to believe that.
And you don't have to believe anything we tell you on this podcast, because
we have nothing to back up this claim except for the fact that we have both worked on sets and are both pretty familiar with film budgets in general from a practical standpoint. And this just does not look or feel like a $100,000 movie. I can personally guarantee you that is not accounting for the marketing budget from A24, which they probably did foot and therefore wouldn't actually be, part of the production budget proper.
Right.
So it's okay that they don't report that. But I'm telling you that the reason you're able to see this movie and even know it exists is because of that marketing budget, which easily puts it in the millions. So, like, that's not being reported.
But like you said, that's usually never reported in film budgets. That's like a separate thing. Daniel Hart score for the film. What do you have to say about this?
Oh, I just thought it was beautiful.
Oh, it was beautiful, yes.
I thought that the music in this movie in general really brought me into the pacing of it. And it just has this sort of low, melancholy vibe. And it's building so slowly throughout the movie. And then when it climaxes in these crazy emotional moments, I just like that the music is telling the story of the movie in the same way the visuals are. Again, this movie just aesthetically really works. I'll just keep saying that. There's a lot to appreciate about this movie from a craftsmanship standpoint.
Did you say 40 people were in the music department?
Yes.
Yeah, that doesn't compute. This is an ad nut.
I would also like for our listeners to know that the $100,000 budget was not mentioned in the notes. This is Arthur's tangent that we're on now. I get called out on my tangents. I'm calling him out on this one. I'm enjoying it. But this is not
a fascinating tangent. Future Arthur, I apologize. This is my fault for sure. But hopefully,
because I didn't even know that going into this recording. I did not.
It's
even
interesting, though. The audience needs to know.
They need to know. They need to know that they're being lied to by movie makers.
Final thoughts.
Great movie. Would recommend. I would recommend watching this movie with a hot mug of tea with some honey and lemon by yourself on a lonely night when it's cold.
So tonight.
That was kind of how I watched it. It was still a little warm when I watched it, but no. It was yesterday. It was fully snowing yesterday. No, it was cold.
It was cold.
Yes.
Fantastic film. Really, really loved it. I was looking up reviews, and one of the ones that I was considering was Robbie Collins' review. And I mean, I liked the pie scene when I watched it, but he put it into a context that really kind of struck me. And I think you brought this up earlier in the episode, Andrew, but the way that scene just lingers and takes forever and how you're there in the moment. And then the film speeds up and then you just lose your grasp on time and everything is just passing by so quickly. And you think back and you're like, no, please take me back to that time when I could just sit and watch Rooney Mara eat the pie, because that was so simple. And now everything is being lost and the house is being torn down and now there's buildings everywhere. And yeah, there was just a sense of relatability to that, right? Like, we're getting older and every year it seems like things are speeding up and you can't believe that it's already October and we're in 2022 and 2017 was 5 years ago, half a decade ago, and it seems like it was just yesterday. And as time is speeding by, you just want to go back and hold on to the things that you're losing, and that can be people. So this film did strike me in a very personal way. It made me want to better appreciate the relationships I have now. And even though I am nostalgic for the past, I mean, now is the present, and that is all we have. And that is okay. And it's a well-done film.
Yes, I would like to also say that for a movie that is trying to sort of instill a sense of confidence into the viewer and a sense of hope, that it also brought me some confidence and hope from a movie watching perspective for us to be so late in this project, so close to the end, and to still be finding movies that are treading new ground and doing different things than any other movie we've seen on this list.
Even though there's sensibilities that are related to like silent films from so long ago, it mm-hmm. still feels new and fresh. That is exciting.
We didn't even really talk about how this movie handles time, but I guess that's just, you know, something you have to figure out.
It's better to watch it and experience the sense of time. But that was one of my big takeaways from the film. That was one of the things that I really, really loved about it, the way it handles time and the passing of time. That's the biggest theme, at least for me.
You know, people say that every year gets shorter, and I agree with that. And I think it comes from this sense, you know how once you've watched a movie a few times, once you've seen a movie more than four times, essentially, it literally seems to go by faster. Your perception of it goes by faster.
Yes, yes, it does.
And I think that that's just how it works with everything. Every day that you're alive for goes by a little bit faster than the one before it, because your perception of days and times is like going faster because you're becoming more accustomed to it. And I like that this film approaches that and displays it in such a visual and recognizable way. And it's just like doing this podcast, truly. When we first started doing this, it felt like almost more of a chore is not the right word, but it just felt like more of a project that was like taking up a certain amount of time. And while it still is doing that, the time doing it does feel shorter.
Mm-hmm.
Would you agree as the editor of the podcast?
Oh, yes.
Yeah, it does go by faster. Yeah. It feels like it goes by faster.
Oh, yes, yes, yes. And it literally just goes faster. I'm a much faster editor now.
But we're not much faster podcasters, because while our audience has not been listening for this long, we have been recording for an hour and 58 minutes. So we need to wrap up. Do you want to tell our listeners what we're watching next week?
It's Mandy, directed by Panos Cosmatos, starring Nicolas Cage.
Yes, so this is the end of our episode. For our regular listeners, thank you so much for tuning in. As Arthur said at the beginning, we would love for you to leave a 5-star rating and review on the podcast streaming service of your choice. Tell a friend or family member about it. I mean, this project is coming to an end, and it feels crazy that it's about to be over, but it's also so exciting for it to be complete. So, yeah, don't forget to tell people about it. Thank you so much to our regular listeners. If you would like more A Century in Cinema, you can join our Patreon. Link to that is in our show notes. And on our Facebook page. Our Facebook page is, of course, called A Century in Cinema. I'm sure Arthur will be inserting a little audio clip right here to tell you what our Patreon episode is this week.
Future Arthur here. And yes, this is a fun one, where we read the enlightening reviews of some of our past films from Redbox, and also see what we missed out on with The Greatest Showman. What do the Redbox reviewers think of The Greatest Showman? Find out more on our Patreon.
So, yeah, whatever Arthur just said, we're going to be doing that. And thank you so much to Nathan Royal for our show's music. And thank you, Arthur, for a wonderful discussion.
It was wonderful. Thank you, Andrew.